layered stories, that is, using little story arcs to build big ones. This is a common technique writers use to build momentum and complexity into a story. We'll be looking at several examples. The first episode of the critically acclaimed television show Gilmore Girls, also Robert Heinlein's classic science fiction novel The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, and the LucasArts classic adventure game Grim Fandango. This week on Be the Story. Hi, I'm Tim King. You're listening to Be the Story, the podcast for and about storytellers. Today we're going to be looking at layered stories, that is, building up complexity in a story by taking deeper storylines and layering them on top of shallower ones. But before that, I want to talk for a moment about what I mean when I say storytelling. Now, storytelling is a performance art. It's rooted in folklore, and storytellers relay through spoken word and sometimes in song the folklore of a culture. But I mean storytelling in a much broader sense. That is, relaying through any means a story. There are certain commonalities between all different media, whether you're talking about performance art or whether you're talking about film or a novelization of some story or even an interactive story such as in an adventure game. So on BeTheStory.com you'll see references or links to resources that have to do with all of these different media. And I want the things that I cover here to appeal and apply to people practiced in all of these different areas. Because I think that we all can agree that what drives interest, or at least what drives my interest in a particular production, whether it's a movie or whatever, is the fact that there is a compelling story that keeps me involved, that draws me into the character's world, and makes me a part of it, makes me want to see what happens and makes me want to see a resolution to any conflicts that are in the story. There are a couple of items here. On BeTheStory.com, Mike posts an interesting comment regarding last week's episode on storyline patents. He notes that the movie Mysterious Skin seems almost to violate Andrew Knight's patent, in that it borrows or implements a great portion of the patented storyline. He writes, quote, "Frightening indeed, especially when you begin to understand how so many writers and filmmakers begin the process with a single image or dream, and then drawing on their skills, flesh it out until it's a story. To begin to fence off creative terrain this way is really a terrible, terrible idea. I'm sure every one of those movies Knight cites as having patentable ideas could be shown to have borrowed them from earlier plots. None of those movies seemed so much original in plot as in presentation. Several were nothing more than it's a dream, or I'm all the characters but didn't know it. This is old stuff, really." Unquote. You see the same sort of problems in software development with software patents. An awful lot of software algorithms have already been done to death. Yet, many software patents get issued for even algorithms that have already been done or that borrow so heavily from prior art that they should not be patented. Working software developers don't have the time to seek out patents for every single software idea they might want to integrate into their software. So they basically proceed as though there are no patented ideas, until a patent holder comes up and says, hey, I have a patent on this particular software algorithm or whatever. And at that point, their employer can decide how to proceed, whether to change the software so that it's not infringing the patent, if that's possible, or to accede to the patent holder's demands, or to challenge the patent in court. None of these is really a good option, especially for a small company. In the film and music industries, it seems intellectual property holders will go after even individuals who they perceive are infringing their intellectual property. Add storyline patents into the mix, and this seems kind of scary to me. How is an independent writer who does not have deep pockets or great resources, how are they going to defend themselves against patent claims? Just a quick note, I continue to make improvements to BeTheStory.com. There are a number of links to related sites, and you can submit basically unedited and unmoderated comments on anything that we discuss here, especially if you disagree. I would love to discuss it with you. You can also email me any suggestions that you might have on what we should talk about in this podcast. And with that said, we'll be back in just a moment talking about layered stories.
Hi, this is Mer Lafferty from Geek Fu Action Grip. I'd like to take a break from this excellent podcast to tell you about Hurricane Katrina. Well, it's very likely you already know about Hurricane Katrina, but what you may not know, and what may interest you, is that in the wake of the disaster, several professionals from the RPG industry, including writers, editors, illustrators, and layout, got together and wrote a book. Beyond the Storm, Shadows of the Big Easy, is a collection of short stories, essays, art, and role-playing game materials inspired by the culture, landscape, and city of New Orleans. With contributions from three continents and from across the spectrum of role-playing, the book has all proceeds from the sale going to support Katrina disaster relief. Join the authors and artists as they explore the Big Easy as it could have been and how it might be in the future. Beyond the Storm is now available for purchase in PDF and print formats. You can check it out at lulu.com or beyondthestorm.us.
Please, please, please.
How many cups have you had this morning?
None.
Plus?
Five, but yours is better.
You have a problem.
Yes, I do.
Junkie.
Angel, you've got wings, baby.
That's the opening scene from the pilot of Gilmore Girls. And you know, opening scenes are really a great place to see this technique of layering in all of its raw glory. Because when you're first opening a new story, you have to establish the characters, you have to establish the environment, you have to establish the conflicts. And in very deep stories, the conflicts are going to be very elaborate, and they're most likely going to be character-based. And this means that they're going to need to be established as the characters themselves are established. So as you learn all about the characters, as you begin to sympathize with the characters and identify with them, you will begin to experience these conflicts and you will be able to understand them. But in the meantime, there's all of this learning that needs to take place. And as an audience, we don't like to sit and just have someone tell us about the characters. No, we want to experience what they experience. We want to be entertained. We don't just want a list of character traits. No, we want to see these characters in action. And for this, we need these kind of little mini-stories, mini-conflicts, that establish a sort of momentum that carries us through over into the deeper parts of the story. Now, the conflict itself doesn't need to be very deep. It doesn't need to be profound. In fact, it could be absolutely trivial, because it really doesn't have to hold our attention for very long. All it has to do is communicate to us some aspect of the character and build the rest of the story. In this particular instance, Lorelai wants a cup of coffee. It's that simple. Yet we begin to sympathize with her, because already we can begin to see her as a real human being, someone who has desires that are not getting fulfilled for some bizarre reason. I mean, all she wants is a lousy cup of coffee. Why would Luke please, please, please not give her what she wants? Well, I guess maybe she is a little bit addicted and overindulging her addiction, so maybe he cares enough about her that he might want to affect how much coffee she consumes. And so already we're beginning to see some of the dynamics between these characters in this tiny little snippet. This, if you watch the episode, is repeated over and over and over again through the first, half of the episode, until enough information has been communicated so that we know all of the characters and we really sympathize and identify with them and identify with the character conflict, which is that Rory is enrolled at Chilton and Lorelai wants her daughter to go to Chilton and has put in all this effort to make it possible for her to do this, and indeed just about humiliated herself in order to get this to happen, and now her daughter has decided she doesn't want to attend the Chilton school, and presumably it's because of a boy. Well, what do you do with that situation? Of course, because Gilmore Girls is a serial drama, the pilot episode is really just the beginning of a much longer storyline. This storyline encompasses the whole first three seasons, which are Rory's years at Chilton. At the end of the third season, Rory has graduated from Chilton, but this is not the only story thread that is wrapped up nicely. Rory's relationship with Dean, the boy that we meet in the pilot episode, and indeed all her romantic relationships, have reached a new status quo. In the pilot, we also learn that Lorelai, the mother, she is the executive manager at an inn, the Independence Inn, and that she and the chef of the Independence Inn, Suki, they have plans someday to open their own inn. By the end of the third season, they are well on their way to seeing that dream come true, and they have conquered all of the initial obstacles that might keep them from achieving that dream. So as you can see, even though the pilot episode stands on its own as a complete story, it is also only one component in a much more elaborate, epic story arc, which encompasses several seasons. So we see that shallower story arcs consistently are used to introduce or to build up elements in the deeper story arcs. There are two kinds of conflicts. There are external conflicts, where the character has to change something outside of himself in order to resolve the conflict, and then there are internal conflicts, where the character has to change something inside of himself. The paradigmatic external conflict is the mystery. The detective has to discover who done it, which is something outside of herself. She has to research, she has to put together all of the clues, and come to a conclusion and reveal the culprit in order to resolve the conflict. Character-based conflicts are very commonly seen in romance stories, where a person undergoes some sort of change, such as falling in love, perhaps overcoming a barrier that he himself has put up that has prevented him from being fulfilled. Plot-based conflicts are generally shallower, and they serve well in smaller arcs, whereas character-based conflicts are generally deeper, and they have to be in the broader arcs in order to be understandable. Now, plot-based and character-based story threads are typically intertwined, but they're still separate, or else the story gets confusing. You see, the story highlights some things for a plot-based thread, but will highlight other things in a character-based one. And intuitively, we as the audience pick up on these signals as we hear the story. The deep story arc does not necessarily need to be character-based, however. You can have complex stories that are mostly plot-based. An example of this is Robert A. Heinlein's classic science fiction novel, The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. The story begins when Manny, the main character, Manny gets a call to come down to the Authority Complex to debug a computer problem. It seems that the Authority's main computer printed a paycheck to a janitor for Authority script $10,185.15, the last five digits being the correct amount. During this service call, we find out that the computer, whom he has named Mike, after Mycroft Holmes, Sherlock Holmes's brother, this computer is actually sentient, self-aware, and that the check he issued, he did not do because of a bug. He did so on purpose, as a joke. So in the first chapter, this quickly fixed conflict is used to show us something about the two main characters of the story, which is not about sentient computers per se, or about jokes, but rather about a revolutionary war of the former lunar penal colony against the lunar authority on Earth. Now, one thing I like about this story is that, you see, Robert Heinlein wrote it in the mid-60s, before anyone had actually gone to the moon. And as a result, the scientific premises on which he bases the book are, we now know, not true. Even so, the way Heinlein weaves this story sucks you in so quickly and so thoroughly that it really doesn't matter. It's very easy, I found, to get over the lack of scientific plausibility and simply accept that in this make-believe world, these are the laws of nature by which everyone must abide. And in this world, the characters fight a revolutionary war against the lunar authority. This happens in three phases. In the first, they declare the revolution, build the revolution, and wrest control from the lunar authority in Luna. In the second phase, the provisionary government prepares for war, and the people elect a more permanent government. In the third phase, the actual war is fought, which will either result in liberty and prosperity, or ultimate annihilation of every human being in Luna. At each point during this story, there are hundreds of problems to deal with, and this provides many, many opportunities for tiny little conflicts that drive the story forward, especially through the more esoteric political theory that you find in the book. By the end of the story, you end up feeling as though the people you've been reading about are real people who live in a real society that actually exists on the moon. And because you identify so thoroughly with them, it's very easy to root for them. One final example I wanted to talk briefly about is Grim Fandango. This is a classic adventure game. In fact, the last of Tim Schafer's great story-based adventures from the days when he was with LucasArts. Since then, he's left LucasArts and started his own studio, Double Fine Productions, who produced Psychonauts, which is another great story-based game. It's actually not a pure adventure or puzzle-based adventure, but a platform game. And I've played through part of it, and I have to say that I'm hooked. As in the old-style classic adventures, he uses story to drive the action forward. By the way, Grim Fandango is still available, direct from LucasArts, and you could probably find it used as well. Like all story-based games, Grim Fandango is strongly plotted. I myself am still looking for a strongly character-based story game. Now, there's an awful lot of great interactive fiction out there that I have not yet played. I'm sure that someone has done a great job writing a strongly character-based interactive fiction game. And all that's left is for me to find it and play it, and then we can talk about it. But the traditional way of doing story-based games is to use plot-driven stories, and this is why most story games are mysteries or science fiction stories. Now, Grim Fandango is based on Mexican folklore in a film noir style. It's set in the Land of the Dead. Here's a little blurb from the travel guide and instruction manual that came with the boxed version of Grim Fandango. The Land of the Dead, according to Aztec beliefs, was a real place where dead souls journeyed for 4 years until they reached the ninth underworld, their final home. To help the souls make their long journey, the dead were buried with money, food, and even dogs. Mexican folklore added humor and festivity to those beliefs by celebrating special days each year when the dead returned to visit their loved ones as honored guests. For the annual fiestas, papier-mâché skeleton dolls were made and dressed in traditional and contemporary costumes. Our hero Manny and the other inhabitants of Grim Fandango's Land of the Dead are modeled after these colorful skeleton dolls called calaveras. Hence the name of the main character, Manny Calavera. I assure you, it's only a coincidence that the main character of Grim Fandango and the main character of The Moon is a Harsh Mistress happen to have the same first name. Anyhow, in Grim Fandango, Manny, the main character, must work off some of the debt that he acquired in his life before he died. That is, he must do some work for the Department of Death in order to earn his way out of the eighth underworld and into the ninth underworld. Therefore, he works as a Grim Reaper. This is community service. But none of his clients are premium clients that qualify for the expensive, easy travel packages that will get them to the ninth underworld in 4 minutes instead of 4 years. As a result, he can't earn enough commission to make it himself out of the eighth underworld. So as we begin the story, we see that Manny needs a premium sale. In our efforts to get him that premium sale, we meet Domino, his arch nemesis, meet Meche, a charity worker whom, for some bizarre reason, does not qualify for any of the premium travel packages. The computer says that she did not lead a virtuous enough life. As a result, Manny is faced with a conspiracy within the Department of Death, a conspiracy which he must uncover and conquer in order to get he himself and his new love, Meche, out of the eighth underworld and into the land of eternal rest. As I said, this story is largely plot-driven. You, the player, must perform individual actions which progress the plot. These actions go together to form story threads, and there could be 3 or 4 different story threads active at once. That is, 3 or 4 different puzzles to solve. In order to solve these puzzles, you must discover what is necessary to progress the plot, what actions Manny must take in order to achieve that plot progression, and cause Manny actually to take these actions. These story threads are arranged into chapters, each of which corresponds to several puzzles. As Manny progresses through each chapter, he comes one step closer to achieving his goal and reaching the 9th underworld, the land of eternal rest. Now, this arrangement is typical of games of this genre, and it's actually kind of a shame that these kinds of games are not produced that much anymore. In fact, Psychonauts is one of the only games currently being published that is a deep story game. Most young game players and most of the game-playing press, and as a result, most game publishers and developers, are more interested in gameplay than in story. On the other hand, someone like me, who is captivated by the story aspects of a game or any other form of art, sees the story as one of the core aspects of the game, and gameplay is only there to support the story. I didn't really mention it, but there are lots of links that I provided in the show notes at bethestory.com. Actually, I consider show notes to be more like a show transcript. I try to provide all of the information that I talk about here, and in addition, lots of additional links. And since it's a blog, there's also an area to leave comments. So definitely, if this topic interests you, check out bethestory.com. But first, in a second, I'm going to give you a little glimpse into what we'll be talking about next week on Be the Story. The last couple weeks of December, I am taking a vacation from my day job, and I intend to use a great deal of that time engrossing myself in various stories, preparing for new episodes of this podcast, which will be published in the new year. So I am soliciting suggestions as to what I ought to be doing during that time, what stories I ought to be checking out. So go to bethestory.com in the upper right-hand corner. There's an email link. Click on that and send me an email. Tell me what you think I ought to be doing the last couple of weeks of December. So that gives you 3 more weeks to do that before we're out of time. I'm keeping a list of all the suggestions I receive and any I think up myself. And it doesn't have to be just stories, I guess. I mean, one of the items already on my list is to read Storyteller by Kate Willem. So whatever your suggestion is, email me. I'll do my best to try to get a hold of that resource. In particular, if you have an opinion and you disagree with me, feel free to email me, or better even yet, go to bethestory.com and post a comment. You can post basically unedited, unmoderated comments on anything we discuss at bethestory.com. Next week, we'll be looking at The Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, one of 2005's most emotional, enjoyable, somewhat misunderstood, ridiculed, and appreciated motion pictures. Yes, love it, hate it, or ignore it, or all of the above, however you feel about it. You must see this movie, and I'll tell you why next week on Be the Story. See you then.